The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman is underwritten in part by Community Capital of Vermont, Green Mountain Power, The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, and by Let's Grow Kids, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're joined this half hour by Rebecca Holcomb. Rebecca Holcomb was appointed the Secretary of Education in January 2014 by Governor Peter Shumlin, and Governor Phil Scott kept her in the job when he took office in January 2017. Holcomb is credited as a driving force behind Act 46, the school district consolidation law that was passed in 2015, and Rebecca Holcomb resigned this year, effective April 1st. Rebecca Holcomb, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You left the job, your job as Secretary of Education, on April 1st. 2 months later, about a week or two ago, you authored an op-ed piece that has appeared in most of the newspapers and on Vermont Digger. It's been titled various things, and Vermont Digger, it says, Scott's veto is a rebuke to voters. What is there a connection between your leaving and your writing careers?
I think they're independent decisions. I mean, I think, you know, always when you've spent your life in public education, you think a lot about education. You think a lot about education finance, because at the end of the day, that's what supports the schools that we have statewide. And as a Vermonter, I'm very invested in the continued well-being of our system and our ability to provide high-quality, sustainable opportunities for kids. You know, you referred to me earlier as the driving force behind Act 46. I really think that the one thing Act 46 did do was ask every community to evaluate itself. And the governor is absolutely correct that as a state with a substantially declining population, I would add growing poverty statewide and a depopulating rural area. Our population is actually held strong in some of our more urban areas. We as a state owe it to our kids to stop every now and then and think about what the implication of globalization, of increased reliance on technology, declining population, fiscal challenges, what are those due to our ability to support high-quality education for kids. And what Act 46 did do was ask every single community to review its operations, review the opportunities, review its local ability to continue to support those opportunities, not now, not next year, not in 5 years, but really in 20 years, because you have to plan as a board for the long haul. And so I think I've followed closely from those points of view. But I'm also very aware and have spent the last 4 years trying to help boards and community members understand that if you want to think about your tax rate because it's too high, you really need to focus on your spending per equalized pupil. You have to look at how much you're spending for child. Because, you know, even in my own town, you know, where we used to serve almost 100 more kids in our elementary school, if we're trying to maintain the same number of teachers, the same program, the same building, and we've got a lot fewer kids, given the way our funding formula works, that's going to contribute to a very, very high tax rate.
Why have you decided to speak out now in the way that you have?
It matters a lot what we do, because how the public responds to the decisions that are made at the state level are ultimately going to drive the affordability of the system. At the most basic level, the signal to local voters when they're spending beyond what they can afford is their tax rate. And when their tax rate goes up, that's a signal to them that maybe they need to rethink what they're doing or how they're operating. And in fact, in some of the earliest merging systems, you do see that many of them were able to even turn in ed spending per pupil that was 1.5% below what it had been the previous year. So they've almost got no tax rate increase. A couple have reduced taxes. And so part of it is you look at that tax rate, right? Because that's the message to you. You know, it's sort of, you know, like, you know, when you earn a salary, you figure out what you can afford. afford in terms of a vacation based on what resource you have available. That's the message that communities get about whether they can support the decisions they're making. And I'm simplifying because the state has also added a lot of new mandates that also add costs that are outside of the control of school boards. But the most basic level, when you buy down tax rates, you erode the signal that communities have about the impact of local decision making. And that's a problem, because if people vote to spend a certain amount of money and then we buy down the implication of that decision,
meaning the state government,
the state government at the state level, then they're going to say, hey, we bought a swimming pool, didn't pay for it, let's spend more. And what we do need to have people thinking about is our shared investment as a state in education, what our individual decisions are doing to drive the affordability of that.
Let's go to the op-ed piece that you wrote. You write, Governor Phil Scott's recent insistence on overriding local budget votes, increasing tax bills regardless of local decisions, and relying on borrowed money is a rebuke of local voters. And then you kind of simplify what has been a dizzying argument, I think I can speak for many people in trying to follow, by having two key objections. One is that you're saying that the governor is proposing to increase taxes, and two is that you say that you go back to that notion that this is a rejection of local voters by the governor, not the legislature. So let's take each of those. Let's start with this rebuke to local voters. What do you mean by that?
Local voters are tasked with deciding how they educate their children. What the state has done is equalize the ability of districts to raise revenue to support their children on a proportional basis. But, you know, Brighton is different than Fayston, and it's different than Burlington. And so what the state has done is given local boards discretion to figure out how to use their tax dollars to provide education for kids. And people in different parts of the state make different decisions based on their needs. But it's difficult to, at the state level, make good decisions about how local people should spend their money, because the situations that they're dealing with are so different. One example is, people have been focusing a lot on the staff to student ratio. I was up in the Northeast Kingdom, and a number of different educators and principals said to me, here's the problem. Our communities are being devastated by opiate addiction. We have young children coming into our school who are severely troubled. We need hands-on to keep them safe and to keep other kids safe. These are systems that actually, in many cases, are low spending on a per-pupil basis, have low tax rates, but do have very low ratios. So they would be the targets of efforts to reduce staff and student ratios. I'm not saying that the solution we're currently providing in our communities for supporting families devastated by opiate addiction is the best solution, but I am saying that you cannot pull staff out without having a viable community-based health support, health safety net that supports families and children in communities that are being devastated by addiction. So we need to be very careful. On the other hand, my town has a high tax rate, has high spending per pupil, and is pretty solid on the ratios. So my point is that what is the biggest cost driver is different in different communities. And you can't sit in Montpelier and come up with one rule that's going to, solve that problem for all communities.
The governor puts it in very simple terms. He says that, look, if we went from a ratio of, four students for every one teacher to five or so students for every one teacher, we'd save a whole lot of money. Why is that so? What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think he's right. He's right that reducing ratios would reduce costs. So, for example, when I spoke to some of the administrators and some of the unified systems that did reduce costs this year, many of them did it because as teachers retired, they were able to reorganize teachers or students across buildings so that they didn't have to refill some of those positions. So they were able to reduce costs quite substantially through attrition. On the other hand, if you look at, and it's on the state the legislature's website, but if you look at the list of highest spending districts in fiscal year 19 in their proposed budgets, many of them have no ratios because they don't operate schools. They're tuition districts. So addressing ratios won't solve their tax rate problem. Many of them are communities that have reasonable ratios. If you look at the group of districts that were singled out in a recent Vermont Digger article, 4 out of 5 were among the higher wealth communities in the state. So the problem is what we really have is, I would argue, increasing geographic concentration of distress, and we need to make sure that as we look for reasons to or ways to improve affordability, we aren't targeting the communities that may be in the most significant distress. We need a much more careful approach to that.
One of the more, we're talking on the Vermont Conversation, we're talking with former Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. One of the charges that you make is, will surprise people. The governor says this is all about taxes, keeping taxes low. You say the governor is proposing to increase taxes. What's the discrepancy?
Well, I think there's two issues to this, and one of them is that it's not actually meaningful to talk about the statewide tax rate because it's just an average tax rate, and what's actually happening is different in every single community. And some communities are seeing tax decreases this year, even if we don't do anything. Some will see tax increases based on, you know, variation in local circumstances and need. So first of all, that statewide tax rate that everyone's talking about is just a funding mechanism that no one's talked about before at the state level that's designed to raise enough revenue statewide to support the budgets that were approved locally, and districts will each pay locally proportional to what they've decided to spend. But when you talk about fixing that statewide average tax rate at the same rate for 5 years out, you're saying that that is the same rate you're going to use to raise revenue. But what people pay locally isn't a tax rate. They pay a tax bill. And that's a pretty big distinction. And actually, it's the bill that matters, because that's how much you have to actually, you know, write your check for. And when you have a projected increase in the common level appraisal, the property value, the grand list based statewide, when that is becoming more valuable, if you apply the same average rate to a growing grand list, you will actually be raising more revenue than you would in year 5 than you would be in year 1. So effectively, you're pulling more money out of communities based on this growing grand list. And at the same time, people's incomes may not have increased. It's just that their property value is now appraised at a higher rate. So that's the problem. And there, the second problem with that is that statewide tax rate has always been set just sufficient to raise enough money to fund the budgets that local voters approved. When you're holding it constant, that means that if these districts actually do make cuts in their local budgets to provide affordability for the state, they will not experience any of that in property tax relief, because we are artificially holding that rate constant even though local voters are choosing to spend less. So then the $1 million question is, well, with all this extra revenue that will be raised in the Ed Fund, where does it go? Because by holding that tax rate constant, you're raising more revenue, more tax money than the districts actually need and have actually voted to spend. So then the $1 million question is, what are we going to do with that extra revenue? And who decides?
Why is this happening? I mean, we're in a situation, and you point out in your op-ed, and we'll link to that on VermontConversation.com, that Governor Scott, in his campaign literature, denounced the very things he's doing now, denounced increasing control by Montpelier over local education budgets, denounced the use of one-time money, which is, as you are explaining, is an artificial way to lower property tax rates. What's going on?
You know, I don't know. I'm not there, but I think what the state is experiencing just statewide is growing fiscal pressure. We have growing adversity in many of our communities. We are increasingly having trouble meeting basic needs. I think many of our communities are seeing a frayed social support network, and that's been a challenge. I think we see stagnant wages. I think we're suffering from a broader sort of depopulation of the Northeast as the economic growth and vitality of the country is increasingly centered on urban areas and not in places like Vermont that aren't urban. And we haven't figured out a viable rural development strategy that's going to allow for vibrant communities into the next century. And I think that's the underlying cause. And what we're doing right now is as people are trying to figure out how to fund, you know, priorities, and priorities differ depending who you are and where you sit, they're going to attribute blame or we're going to attribute responsibility in different places. And there is no question that that we need to do, you know, it's funny, you know, I spent 4 years working with school boards and superintendents. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who didn't say we needed to address affordability in school budgets. They all agree. They just think it can't be done quickly. And, you know, at the same time, they've been pretty vocal that they'll do their bit, and they believe that they should do their bit. That's why they turned in budgets that were almost $30 million less than projected. But, you know, they're also, sometimes they need the legislature to help them to make some changes. I think the special ed bill is a pretty good example. We know that, you know, people often talk about how much we spend on education. It's about $18,300 per, you know, $400 per kid, you know, per kid. About 20% of that almost is spent on special education. So when we've been working over the last couple of years, what we're targeting is places where we think there's the greatest opportunity to find both improvement in service, but also greater affordability for communities.
Earlier this week, Vermont Digger ran an excellent article looking at one of the kind of subtexts to all the education debates, which is over privatization of schools, and noted that Governor Scott's recent appointment to the State Board of Education, Oliver Olson, brings to almost half of the State Board of Education are people. Oliver Olson was on the board of Burr and Burton in Manchester. Are representatives from private schools. I think it's something like 95% of Vermont students attend public schools, and now nearly half of the State Board of Education are representatives with a background in private school education. Are you concerned that there is a growing movement to privatize education in Vermont?
Well, I would, if your goal is affordability, I think it would be a risky one. I think 95% of our kids are in public schools. I think that speaks to a commitment to a community-based school model in many communities. I think education in Vermont and also early care and learning in Vermont is a mixed delivery model. I think the larger question moving forward will be in a system where some education is provided through private contractors, what's the right way to manage that to ensure state goals? And my concern would just be that when you're using taxpayer dollars, the investment of taxpayer dollars has to ensure state goals, not just individual goals.
One of the points made in that article that I think people will find very surprising is that private schools enjoy a lot of exemptions in Vermont. Exemptions around special education services that they have to provide. And also many of the proposals like reducing student-teacher ratios that Governor Scott is proposing exempt these private schools. Explain what these exemptions are, and how can this be that we're applying more and more pressure to public schools, but we have this kind of free pass lane for all the private schools here?
I think it probably has to do with the region. You know, it's interesting, there have long been, actually up until about 1990, the schools were in statute as public schools with private governance, and it reflected the fact that in many of our more rural communities, they didn't have enough population to have a community-based high school in particular. And over time, some of those public schools with private governance actually became public schools as we know them today. You know, if you think of BFA, for example. And some of them chose to become independent schools in statute under the current agreement. And then there's Stepford Academy, which is unique in the state in being a designated school. It's a private school, but it functions as the public school for the town in which it sits. So there's still a pretty big diversity in that sector. There are also private schools that specialize in students with severe disabilities or, you know, have mental health purposes, therapeutic purposes that are unique to those schools. I think it is true. I think it is, you know, I was teasing my husband the other day that one of the unintended consequences of Dodd-Frank was that we stopped investing in small business development, and that's key to having a private and strong economic development and growth. One of the challenges is if you penalize certain behaviors over time and then you incentivize growth in another sector, you may end up with unintended consequences. And I think part of the challenge is if people feel that it's unfair that all of the cost containment is on one side, they may reject cost containment, which is actually something we need to pay attention to. So probably cost containment needs to be something that's spread broadly over all sectors. In this case, it's true that the healthcare clawback last year didn't touch the unionized teachers in the independent schools. It did touch the unionized teachers in the public schools. I think you're correct. We know that on average, many of the, with the exception of the six biggest schools, most of the schools in the independent sector are actually smaller and have smaller ratios than the public schools on average. So it is a conversation that we'll probably have to have. And then there's the equity and access. And the reality is if schools are closing due to competition, we do need to make sure that the schools that remain open in those regions are open enrollment and are willing to serve kids from those communities.
Education inspires a lot of heat from many constituents because you oversaw a number of pretty momentous changes in the system of Vermont. Act 46 is, probably one of the biggest ones on your watch. What are you proudest of what you were able to accomplish as Secretary of Education under two governors?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I would just say that it was the greatest privilege of my life. And one of the things I've always known about education is no matter what you do, you make some people mad because you can't give people enough. It's, there's nothing we care about more than our children. I think the thing, probably the thing I'm proudest, I'm proud of a lot. I'm incredibly proud of the staff of the agency. I think it had gone through some tough years. I don't think the general public knows this, but the agency gets about 40% less in general fund and inflation-adjusted dollars than it did in 2008. And so it was struggling, and not through any fault of its own, but going through the same process now the state is trying to deal with more broadly, thinking about, in a time of greater constraint, how do you make strategic decisions about how you invest your energy to try to get more value for the state of Vermont out of the money and in the application of your people? And then the other thing I'm really proud about is we've really worked hard to figure out how to leverage the strength of our communities, and because I don't think there's a way to have strong schools if you don't have strong local leadership. And we designed a process as part of our education quality review process that it's really a peer review model that brings people from different supervisory unions and districts to visit and give feedback and gather data and provide evidence to peers and other school systems. And so it's sort of a mandatory visitation policy, if you will. And the sharing and the when you have a school system come and visit another school system that's dealing with very similar challenges, their ability to be very candid both about the limitations but also the opportunities, and to be able to call out things that are working really well. Because we do have many places in the state where people have figured out extraordinary ways to leverage small and make it work and in a very affordable way. We need to find ways to figure out where things are working and begin to share them out and bring them to scale. And this integrated field review process that got school systems visiting each other and gathering data through these visits has been very effective at sort of culling out and celebrating some of the things that are effective strategies for a very strong rural future, and I'm very positive about some of that.
What are you most concerned about for Vermont education looking forward?
I think it's the same challenge, frankly, that we have at the state level. What we have is, partly due to increased globalization and increased the effects of technology. I think what we've seen is a concentration of advantage. What drives prosperity and, frankly, what drives enrollments in our communities is very often it's affluence. We're seeing concentrating privilege and concentrating disadvantage. I really worry about that if we don't come up with a viable rural strategy to help some of our less populated communities, I think we're in trouble as a state. And then the other is we have to learn how to talk to each other. And the conversation right now has become so polarized and intractable that we are unable to come together around practical solutions.
Okay, well, Rebecca Holcomb, former Secretary of Education, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at vermontconversation.com. I'm David Goodman. We'll be back next week with another Vermont Conversation. Thanks for listening.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is on.